So after being everybody exhausted after the first lecture of quantum field theory, let us start the course on statistical mechanics. And so I gave you these handouts, this is the plan. And so the main topic of this course is phase transitions and critical phenomena. We will do it in three stages. So the first week, we'll cover some preliminaries where I will review thermodynamics, I'll review the basics of statistical physics, and a thermodynamic approach to phase transitions. And basically, next week, we'll do the microscopic theory of phase transitions. So everything will be demonstrated on an Ising model, which is like the simplest and the most beautiful and the easiest, but not really, example how to study phase transitions. And then we will work. You know, we will go through several stages. So we will first discuss the mean field theory, and then we will show how actually the mean field theory description of the Ising model can be sort of translated to field theory. And then we will discuss Wilsonian renormalization. And then last week, we will cover some more advanced topics. So Loren will talk about Monte Carlo simulations in statistical physics. And we will talk about systems with continuous symmetry and stuff like that. Okay, so now additional reading is that I'll be uploading and updating the study text on the PSI wiki. So PSI wiki is still not working, but hopefully today it will be fixed. I also recommended some other textbooks. So the first one by Atkins, Equilibrium Thermodynamics. I really love that book. It's thermodynamics. It's just the first lecture about in this course, but it's really beautifully written, and it's like from a theoretician point of view written, so it's quite nice. Of course, Landau and Lipschitz is a very standard book on statistical physics, Patria Statistical Mechanics, and then I put some random sources for critical phenomena. So, if you have time, which you will not have, just read some of the books. So now, there's 9 tutorials, 3 homeworks. Everything has to be submitted on time. And there'll be an interview after that. OK. Very good. Are there any questions? If no questions, so chapter 1, preliminaries. This is still not dry, so it's a disaster. And then part A will be review of thermodynamics. And so let me start with that beautiful quote by Arthur Eddington. So if someone points out to you that your pet theory, which you just created, of the universe is in disagreement with Maxwell equations, well, then so much the worse for Maxwell equations. If it is found to be contradicted by observation, well, these experimentalists, they do bungle things sometimes. But if your theory is found to be against the second law of thermodynamics, I can give you no hope, and there is nothing for it but to collapse in deepest humiliation. So really, he highlighted the principles of thermodynamics about all theory we actually know about above Maxwell equations, even above the experimental evidence. So here is really strongly believe that thermodynamics is the right theory. And it can be the right theory because it's very general. There is no, it's just basically general principles which always have to be valid. Okay, so what is thermodynamics? So it interrelates directly observable macroscopic quantities for example, like the pressure of a gas or volume of the gas or whatever, without any microscopic assumptions. So really you are asking, I don't have a macroscopic theory of my phenomena, but what in general I can actually say about the system, and it's precisely what thermodynamics tells you. So now this is done with the help of some abstract new quantities. So you have new quantities or new concepts. And so three of them are really, really fundamental. And so if you introduce these three, then you can basically talk in generality about the systems. And so one of them is that of temperature. T. And the second one is the internal energy. U. And finally, we have the entropy. And the statement is, once you introduce this concept, then actually you can tell a lot about the systems. So now, to introduce these concepts, you need some postulates or some laws. And precisely to each one of these concepts, actually, there is one law. So the temperature sort of follows from the zeroth law of thermodynamics. And the internal energy is discussed by the first law. And entropy is introduced in the second law. Okay, so we have three laws to introduce three quantities, which will help us to study things. So now, of course, you want to describe these thermodynamic variables. So for example, how the pressure of a gas evolves or whatever. So you need these thermodynamic quantities. And you can classify them into several groups. So basically, one classification is that they are intensive, which means of local character. So example of an intensive quantity would be, for example, the pressure, the electric intensity, temperature, the density of the gas, and whatever. So everything that is, you know, locally characterized at a point. Versus that, you have extensive quantities. Which basically describe the system as a whole. So typically, you would have mass, volume, the internal energy, and stuff like that. So everything which describes, you know, you need to know the whole system. The whole system has total mass, m, and stuff like that. So now, what actually turns out to be is that the thermodynamic quantities often appear in conjugate pairs. So for example, temperature, entropy, pressure, volume, tension, surface area, or whatever, such that the product of these two quantities has units of energy. You know that TdS has units of energy, as well as PdV, as well as tau dA. Okay, so thermodynamic quantities often appear in these conjugate pairs. So now what thermodynamics really describes is how things behave when everything settles down. So if you are in thermodynamic equilibrium. Thermodynamic equilibrium. Which means approximately no further changes take place. So in other words, if you wait long enough, then you may be, in the end, in thermodynamic equilibrium. Of course, this may not happen always, and there are some special conditions or special cases where thermodynamic equilibrium is never restored. But typically, generically, it will be. Okay. And of course, a subset of this is thermal equilibrium, so specifically thermal equilibrium. Is such that so you will have two systems in thermal equilibrium if you allow them to exchange heat, if you allow them to be in contact thermally, but you don't allow them to do some mechanical work. So, for example, you can have one gas with this pressure and this density, another gas with another pressure, another density, but you let them interact thermally. And so in the end, they will have something, they will be in thermal equilibrium, they will have the same temperature, but they not necessarily have to be in mechanical equilibrium. If I release the bar in between them, then there will be some mixture and work done and stuff like that. So thermal equilibrium, so in thermal contact, for a long time. Okay. So now, different processes may happen. So you can start heating the system, you can start expanding the system and stuff like that. But some changes you do to the system, some processes are nicer than the others, and the nice processes are called reversible processes. So process is reversible. If basically two things happen, first it is quasi-static, what it means is basically slow enough, so basically a quasi-static process is such that at each point of the process, basically, I still have thermodynamic equilibrium. So I'm doing the change so slowly that each point there is enough time to equilibrate and enough time to restore the equilibrium. So if it's slow enough, this will be true. We will see in cosmology course that not always you can do it. And so if you have rapidly expanding universe, actually there is not enough time to equilibrate, and then you have to do kinetic theory and stuff like that, but it's not described by thermodynamics. Okay, so quasi-static and plus, and this stupid word, no hysteresis. Basically, what it says is that, yeah, it has to be reversible. So typical example of hysteresis is the iron thing. So you have the graph B versus H thing, and you have probably seen on your high school a graph something like this. So if you start with importing, so you start here, and then you do these changes, but you don't return back to the same thing. So, of course, this is not a reversible process, right? So everybody's familiar with this picture, I guess. Okay, so if these two conditions are satisfied, then we have a reversible process. And so reversible processes are nice and will play a role in second law of thermodynamics and stuff like that. Are there any questions to basic concepts? Okay. So now, let me start with the zero law. So, zero law. So it's a law which basically allows you to define temperature. And the law tells you something like that. If two systems are separately in thermal equilibrium, with a third system they are also in thermal equilibrium. Equilibrium,
with each other. Okay, so that's the zero law of thermodynamics. And basically what it tells you is that you can split systems into equivalence classes, those that have the same, if two are in equilibrium with the third, then also one and third has to be. So now, as I said, this allows you to actually introduce the temperature. But this won't be the thermodynamic temperature as you know it, but rather what you can introduce is an empirical temperature. So from here, can define empirical temperature. And of course, historically, this was done in terms of gas thermometry. So people played with gases and with heat engines and stuff like that. So that's where it comes from. And of course, it's the temperature. So you have Celsius degrees. And so somebody introduced the temperature measured in Celsius degrees. They used water and stuff like that. So we will use the gas. And so there's an experimental fact that if you use an ideal gas, so state of gas is typically characterized by two properties. So characterized by temperature and volume, and these two quantities. You want to introduce temperature, so that wouldn't be good. By pressure and volume. So typically, these two quantities can be independent. By P and V, which are independent. However, if it's in thermal contact with another gas, then only one of them is actually independent. So if in thermal equilibrium with another gas, then only one is independent. Okay, so now I'll drive you through a formal proof that we can introduce an empirical temperature, which is quite fun. So let's just do it. So let's solve system 1 and 2 in thermal equilibrium with 3. So the system or the gas number 3 we will use as thermometer. Okay. So now what we are saying is that so 1 is in equilibrium with 3. So 1 and 3, that means that there must exist a function called F1, which connects the properties of the system 1 with the properties of system 3, and it gives a constraint. So this is the constraint. So P1, V1, P3, and V3 equals to 0. Okay, so that's the constraint, which constraining P1 and V1 in terms of so the other system is in P3 and V3, but there must be a constraint. Okay. So similarly, 2 and 3 are in equilibrium. So there must be another function, F2, which now relates P2, V2, V3, and V3 equals to 0. And then the function is in general different. Okay. So now what you can do is that you can solve both equations for P3. Okay, so from here, I can just, I have some algebraic relation here, and I can solve for P3. So P3 will be now function of P1, D1, and V3. Okay. And similarly, I'll solve for P3 here as well. And V3. Okay. So far, so good. So now, of course, this P3 is exactly the same as that P3 because it's just a pressure of my thermometer. Okay, so I can equate the two. So I'm getting that this thing equals to that thing. Okay, so we get from here that P3, which is function of P1, V1, and V3, must be the same P3 as here, which is P2, V2, and V3. Okay, it's still the same pressure. And this is an algebraic relation. So again, I know whatever this is, some expression in P1, V1, and V3, to some expression in P2, V2, and V3. So I can solve this for something. And so let's solve this for P1. So, and this is if and only if P1 is a function of, now, so I eliminate P1, so it'll be a function of P1, V3, V2, and P2, okay? So this is just solving that constraint for P1. That was hard work. Okay, so far we said, well, one is in equilibrium with three, and two is in equilibrium with three. We haven't used the Zero's law, which is, of course, we have to. So we now use the Zero's law, and then we conclude, yeah, one and two actually have to be in thermal equilibrium as well. Okay, so one and two are in the term by Zero's law. Okay. So that means that we can repeat this argument. So now there's F3 of P1, V1, P2, and V2 has to be equal to zero. There must be this relation between P1 one and two. And so solving this for P1, P1 is P1 of V1, V2, and P2. Okay, so this is what we conclude by the Zero's law, that this must be true. So now, of course, you want to compare equation 1 and the equation 2, and you see that the equation 2 is almost equation 1, except somehow V3 has to drop out. Okay, so in 1, so conclusion is that V1 in 1, V3 in 1 has to drop out. Okay, so this guy cannot be here. But if the guy is not here, it cannot be here either, because this is equivalent to that. So this guy also has to drop out, and that guy also has to drop out. If it drops out there, then you conclude that there is some universal function of P1, V1, which is equal to, so this equation, let's call it 3. So 3 implies that there's some universal function of P1, V1. It must be equal to another function of P2, V2. So F P1 and V1 equals to F of P2 and V2. But of course, left-hand side of this relation is a function of P1 and V1. Right-hand side is a function of P2 and V2. These things are not the same. So both sides have to be equal to something, which is constant. And this is the empirical temperature. Eta equals the constant. So in other words, we conclude that F, P, and V equals to theta is our thermal temperature. And so you see that for each gas separately, whatever it has P1 and V1 is always tied by this theta, the constant, which is in our thermal equilibrium. So this is the empirical temperature. Yes?
Why do the functions like one function? Because in the original equation, that's three.
Even if it is not, then they are equal, right? So, yeah. So all I'm saying is that whatever the left hand side, okay.
The number.
I think even if you could do something like that, it would still be the same theta, yeah, which is a constant because left hand side is function of something different than right hand side, yeah. Yeah. So this is the empirical temperature as introduced for the gas. And of course, now you can extend the temperature for anything else, because you can always put it in thermal equilibrium. I can put my chalk in thermal equilibrium with the gas, and then I will assign the same empirical temperature as the gas has. Okay. So this is how you introduce the empirical temperature. Questions? Okay, well, this is good. So now we have the temperature. So now let's move to the first law and introduce the internal energy. So first law. So now I'll formulate it in two steps. But basically, what we want to do is, well, we need two steps because we're actually defining two quantities. We are defining what internal energy is, and we are defining what heat is. Okay, and so let's do it in two steps. So let's first say, well, there is no heat, and explain what the internal energy is. And once we know what internal energy is, let's go for the heat. So step one, you say that if you have a thermally isolated system, four thermally isolated system, there exists a function of state called the internal energy. Internal energy U, so that du equals to dv, let this guy work on the system. Okay, so you say, so first you isolate the system, so you basically forbid any heat exchange, right? So you only allow there to be mechanical work, basically. And then you say, well, if this is true, I can introduce something which is a total differential here. That's something I call internal energy, and it's equal to the work, which in this case also the total differential. So what does it mean that it's total differential? Is that if I go from one point in the phase diagram to another point, then no matter which path I take, I always have to do the same amount of work. I have to do the same amount of, I change the internal energy by the same amount, u. Okay, so this is really a total differential. So that's the step one. So now, of course, step two is that you say, well, now I allow actually to do also some changes which have nothing to do with the work. So I allow the heat to flow, actually. So step two, if system not thermally isolated, some things can still be happening. One can also change the state of the system. Without doing work. And this precisely corresponds to heat. So heat delta Q or Q measures to which extent the change is not ID, but the change is not adiabatic. Okay, so adiabatic means I don't allow nothing happening. So this is a definition of what adiabatic basically means. Okay, so if I have heat, it's not adiabatic. Okay, so if something is happening, so I put the two systems together, and there is no work, but they still keep changing. So I don't know, the thermometer shows that the empirical temperature is changing, and something is happening, and precisely corresponds to the heat flow. Okay, and so it measures how non-adiabatic the system is. Yes.
Okay, so why don't we just say heat is a form of work exactly?
Because it's, we will see that it's not, that actually heat is a poor cousin of work. It's something like work, but not really. Okay, so now this is all words. So it's like the second law of Newtonian mechanics, right? You are at the same time defining what mass is, and at the same time you are defining what force is, right? The only thing which you know in the second law is the acceleration. And somehow you have to define both quantities. You have to define the mass as resistance with respect to the acceleration, but you also have to define the force as something which is actually accelerating your system. Okay, so here we are defining both quantities, and you have to do it in clever way so that it's not cyclic. And this is basically the clever way. So you define U and you define Q at the same time, basically. So now the first law, of course, reads du equals to delta Q plus delta V. So now this is still my function of state. So still, if I have one point in the phase diagram and another one, then this is a total differential. However, this one is not, and this one is not in general. But their sum is. Okay. And so the convention here is that this is the final minus the initial. And this is work done on the system, and this is heat transferred to the system. And this is work done on the system. Okay, so the picture in mind, something like that. So I'm flowing in my parameter space. I have U initial here. I have U final here. And of course, there is many, many paths. I can go from this path to that path. So let's say this path, I am just changing. I'm just working, and I'm not no heat. So this will be delta V on this path, let's say. But there is another path which leads to the same point where actually I am allowing to also, you know, heat flow, and then none of the work nor the heat actually are total differentials. They are not functions of state. Okay, so only if I specify which which path I'm taking, I can sort of distinguish work from heat here. Okay. So now, because I'm saying I have this convention, this is the final minus initial, and then heat transfer to system and work, then also this allows you to actually define what a hotter and colder is. And so you just define it by a convention. So you say that the heat flows from hotter to colder. So if I don't do any work, I just let the heat flow, then I'll say this is the heat transfer to the system, so that gives me the sign. And so now I say fixing the sign by saying, well, this is hotter or colder. Okay. So now we have heat and we have work. Yes?
Sorry. So the fact that you know that heat or that heat flows in like a in a well-ordered way, is that just an empirical fact?
No. So okay, so what I'm doing here is I'm just switching off the work term. So I have du equals to delta q. Okay. So now let's say I say that du is positive.
Okay.
So if du is positive, then the internal energy is increasing.
Yeah.
Okay. And so for that, I have to have delta q positive. So that means that actually I am transferring heat to the system. So the system is absorbing heat. Okay. And so now you say, well, if it's positive or negative, you can choose which one. So you define one to be hotter and one to be colder. So now your definition of hotter is such that if I don't if the internal energy is decreasing, okay, then the heat actually flows out. Okay, and I define such a system, hotter or colder.
Okay, so you're just saying the system is hotter, it's colder when energy leaves, or you're saying it's colder than the system.
If I don't do any work, this is what about, yeah.
But are you saying the other system is colder because the heat flows to it?
Basically, yes. Okay. Yeah.
So how do you know you can't have three systems where like one flows to the other flows to the third, but then it doesn't, like the third flows to the first?
I wonder if it follows from the zeros law. Maybe it doesn't. A good question. Okay, remember that question. If I don't answer it in the following, then we can discuss later.
Okay.
Yeah. Okay, so this is just a definition. Okay, this is just a definition of what I mean by hotter. Okay, so now typical examples of works. So example of work terms as you know them. So this is boring part. So delta W, for example, minus PdV. So this is the hydrostatic pressure work. Another one would be tau dA. So if you have a bubble with surface tension tau and you want to increase its area, you have to do this work. Okay. So of course you have many more examples of work. For example, the work of electric fields. The work as you know it. So the work terms typically come from some fundamental laws of physics. You can also define heat capacity. So because you know what heat is, you can now differentiate it. And so the generalized heat capacity will have many subscripts. So beta, gamma, and so on. And this is defined as delta, q, alpha, beta, and so on, divided by d alpha. So this is a generalized capacity. So for example, So I'm changing the variable alpha. So changing variable alpha while keeping beta and gamma variables constant. While beta, gamma, and so on variables held constant, okay. And so why you have to fix these variables alpha and beta is because you have to say this delta q is not a total differential. So you have to say which path you are taking. Okay, so along one path, delta q will be some. Along another path, delta q will be different. So that's why you have to specify the path along which you are going. And that, so you are keeping some of these variables fixed. So if you have n degrees of freedom in your system, you can change one, alpha, but you have to keep all the others actually fixed to specify the path. Okay, so to specify path we are taking. Of course, this looks very abstract, but in practice, all we need is CP and CV. So CV is actually CVT, which is delta Q over dt at constant V. So that's the heat capacity for the constant volume. And then heat capacity for constant pressure, CPT delta Q dt at constant pressure. Okay. So these are typically the two which you encounter in practice calculations. But more generally, this will be the heat capacity as you can define it. Okay. So we have temperature, we have internal energy. If you notice that the first law of thermodynamics is basically like a conservation of energy, so you are saying, well, there is some form of energy which I call internal energy. It equals to some sum of other two energies, which is work and heat. Okay. So now this is not the only constraint you have. You can have processes which preserve the energy, but still cannot happen in nature. Okay. And so this is basically the substance of second law. So second law second law basically tells you two things, is that not all energetically, well, processes that are energetically possible actually can happen. Okay, so that's basically the meaning of that. It also tells you, so that's one possible formulation if you want. Another possible formulation is that actually the heat which we introduce over there, heat is a less noble cousin of work. Okay, and the reason is that you can always turn work to heat, but not always you can change heat to work. So in some sense, even if energetically they are equal, So work is more noble. It can choose to be either work or heat. But heat, actually, once it is heat, it's sort of lost. And you cannot turn it to work completely. Okay, so that's two very vague formulations of second law. So now to formulate it more precisely, you have to talk about heat engines. So heat engine so it's something which, you know, changes heat to work and stuff like that. And of course, what you would ideally want it to be is that it operates in cycles, and after each cycle, it returns back to the initial conditions, so that actually you can repeat a cycle and you can repeat doing the same process. Otherwise, of course, everybody can extract the energy once, but you want to operate this continuously and repeatedly. So works in cycles. And returns after each cycle to its initial state. Okay, so that's our definition of heat engine. And so now, of course, you are interested in, so the heat engine typically operates between two thermal baths. So you have one thermal bath, which is over here, which you will call hot. And then you have another thermal bath, which you call cold. And now you have this heat engine E. And so typically what happens is that the engine extracts some heat from the hot bath. It does some work for you. And then it turns out that it also has to transfer some heat to the cold bath. Okay, so this is a typical thing how the engine works. So it grabs heat from hot, puts some heat to cold, and does some work. So now, how good this engine is, you measure by thermal efficiency. So thermal which is defined by following relation. So thermal efficiency eta is given by work out. You will call engine better if you can get more work out of it, and then heat in. So typically it's more difficult to keep the warm bath. So actually extracting heat from hot bath, actually you have to, you know, repeat that. So this is the thing which you have to work against. So the efficiency is work out divided by heat in. So it's W over Q1. But of course, the conservation of energy has to apply. So work is nothing else than Q1 minus Q2, ideally. So this is Q1 minus Q2 divided by Q1. So this is 1 minus Q2 over Q1. And so that's the thermal efficiency of the engine. So of course, you want to make it as big as possible. So ideally, it would just be shifting Q1 to W. Okay, so this is how a heat engine is defined and how its efficiency is defined. So now you want to, so there are different examples of heat engines. And perhaps the most familiar is the Carnot's heat engine. Okay, so an example of a heat engine will be Carnot cycle or Carnot heat engine. And if you want, it operates in the PV diagram. So I have P and V. And so it's very simple what you draw here. It's basically you have two isotherms, one and another one. You start here at point A. And so you follow the isotherm on theta 1 to some point B. And at point B, you switch to an adiabat. So this is an adiabat. And so you get to point C here. So here I'm expanding the gas, keeping its temperature constant. Here I'm expanding the gas, not allowing any exchange of heat. And then I'll be compressing the gas on some different isotherm, theta 2. And then I'll be compressing the gas on another adiabat. Okay. So now, as I'm expanding here the gas, I have to actually get the heat Q1. As I'm compressing the gas here, I'm extracting the heat Q2. And if you are interested in the work, it's of course the area in between. This is the work. So this is an example of a heat engine, and you just compress it out of these two simple processes. And so the workout is really the area in between these things. So now what is wonderful about this engine is that it is reversible. So actually, you can reverse the process to go the other way around. So at the expense of work, I can actually heat the warmer, the hotter bath, and cool even further the cold bath. So if I do the work, I heat the hotter bath. If I want to extract the work, I use Q from the hotter bath. So this is reversible, and that's very, very important. Okay. Questions? So that's the setup. So now we know what heat engines are, and we know a particular example of a heat engine. So now let's formulate precisely the second law. And there's many, many formulations of second law. So let me choose two, which are quite convenient. You can probably formulate your own version of second law. There's lots of versions named by famous people. So if you convince people that your formulation is useful, then you become a famous person as well. So, second law, due to Kelvin, and so he's saying no process is possible false. So result is the complete conversion of heat to work. Okay, so really, heat is not so nice as work because I cannot convert it to work just doing that. So a different formulation due to Clausius. So he's saying no process is possible, blah 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 again, holds, so result. Is the transfer of heat from colder to hotter body. Okay. So these are two formulations. So I cannot transfer heat from cold to hot, just transferring the heat. And at the same time, I cannot change heat to work. Okay. So now let me show the equivalence. So equivalence of the statements. So I really like these proofs, because they are just drawing pictures. And so I think it's really, really beautiful. And it teaches you how to think about thermodynamics. So if Clausius were not correct, so if Clausius were violated, then I could actually transfer from cold to hot. So I could build an engine. So it'll be hot. And then this is my engine. And then this is cold, such that I could simply transfer the heat to the engine, and the heat would transfer, the engine would transfer the heat to my hot bath. And let's call this, for the reason see later, the heat Q2. So if Clausius were not right, this would be possible. So now let's use this in connection with a normal engine. So normal engine. So I'll have the same thing here, hot and cold. So now this is the typical picture. Work. So now I am eating Q1. I'm returning back Q2, and the work is, of course, Q1 minus Q2. This is my normal engine. So now if I compose the Clausius violating engine with my normal engine, and I arrange that this Q2 is the same as that Q2, of course, the total engine will not be doing anything with the cold bath. So this is equal to hot and cold. This is my new engine. And so this one is simply extracting Q1 minus Q2 and turning it into a work Q1 minus Q2, and it's not doing anything with the cold bath. So now, by composing the Clausius violating engine with the normal engine, I constructed a new engine which simply changes heat of the hot bath, or of one bath, to the equal amount of work. And of course, that violates Kelvin's formulation. Okay, so this is sort of a proof that the two formulations are equivalent. Happy times. Okay, so this is good. So we have two formulations of the second law. So now let us have a look how actually this introduces the entropy. So you will show in your tutorial today that based on these two formulations here, you can actually prove Carnot's theorem. Okay, so Carnot's theorem. And so this is a very self-centered theorem. So it's really promoting Carnot. Why not? So he's saying, well, there's no more efficient engine than my engine. Nobody can build more efficient engine than I do. Okay, so that's the statement of the theorem. So no engine. Operating. So nobody should even try, right? No engine operating between two given reservoirs, can be more efficient than my engine. Okay, so this is a very good trick how to get rid of the concurrence. So if somebody competing for the money, then you'll say, well, I actually have theorem. Nobody can be better than I am. So this is a theorem, which is, yeah, okay. But unfortunately, it has for Carnot, diminishing consequence. So actually, as a consequence, it's actually all reversible engines and again blah blah operating between the two given reservoirs are equally efficient. So it is true that Carnot's engine is the most efficient, but it's not the only one. Actually, any engine which is reversible will have exactly the same efficiency. Unfortunately for Carnot, so he couldn't get rid of the competition completely, but at least he's saying, well, it's reversible. Okay. So as I said, you will prove these two statements based on the second laws in your tutorial today. So now let me just use them to really introduce the temperature and entropy. Okay, so let's take a reversible engine. And so what we are saying here that all reversible engines will have the same efficiency. But of course, the efficiency depends only on the fraction of Q2 over Q1, or Q1 over Q2. So that's how the efficiency is defined. So what we are saying is that that Q1 over Q2, well, can only depend on the properties of the two reservoirs, in particular, on their temperatures. Okay, so this must be some function of theta 1 and theta 2, which are the empirical temperatures of my two reservoirs. It cannot be anything else. So for every reversible engine, this must be true. Okay. So now here comes, of course, another picture which shows the truth. So now we compose two such engines together. So you have, yeah, maybe better here. So you have a bus with temperature theta 1. And so this is my engine 1. And then you have a bus with temperature T2. But you use it as a hotter bus for engine 2. And then you have theta 3. So now I'm extracting Q1. I'm giving back Q2. I'm extracting the same Q2. I'm giving back Q3. And so there's W1 and there's W2. Okay. So let's E1 and E2 be reversible engines, which I compose together in this way. So for the first engine, we have this, Q1 over Q2, must be some function, universal function, theta 1, theta 2. Then for engine 2, I must have Q2 over Q3, must be function of theta 2 and theta 3. But of course, I can understand the whole picture as a new engine, E3, which goes directly from theta 1 to theta 3. So E3, theta 1, theta 3. So then I have Q1 over Q3 is F theta 1 and theta 3. So now I multiply everything. So I have Q1 over Q3, which is F theta 1, theta 3, is equal to Q1 over Q2, Q2 over Q3, which is F theta 1, theta 2, F theta 2, theta 3. Okay? So now basically what you are doing is that you are looking for a universal function F, which satisfies the property that for any quantities, f theta 1 theta 3 is equal to f theta 1 theta 2 times f theta 2 theta 3. Okay, so this is what you are looking for. And then you ask your friend mathematician, what is the function? And he tells you it's just a fraction of theta 1 over theta 2. Okay. Something I was never convinced of. Okay. All right, so we have the solution is that from here, a mathematician tells you that the function f of theta 1 and theta 2 is some fraction of another function t of theta 1 divided by t of theta 2. Okay. So there must be some other function t, which is a function of theta 1, and the same function t of theta 2. So that this is true, and then you can check that the equation is satisfied. So in other words, we are concluding that Q1 over Q2 is just T1 over T2, where I call T1 T of theta 1, and T of theta 2 I call T2. And okay, so this is true. And then the eta for reversible machine will just be given by 1 minus T2 over T1. Of course, T is the thermodynamic temperature.
So how come you change this?
Okay, so T, the thermodynamic temperature must be a function of theta 1, and this is how you do it. You just look at the efficiency of heat engines, of the reversible heat engines. And so this allows you to introduce the thermodynamic temperature, namely the relation between something universal and something which is an empirical thing, which can, you know, be different for different substances or whatever. OK, so we have the thermodynamic temperature now. So as a bonus, we will have also the entropy. So Carnot's theorem tells me that the efficiency of any engine must be small or equal than the efficiency of reversible engine. So 1 minus Q2 over Q1 is more than equal than 1 minus T2 over T1. So the right-hand side is efficiency of the reversible engine for which we formulated this. And the left-hand side is just efficiency of any engine, as we defined it over there. So now, of course, 1 cancels. And then you can put both things on the left-hand side. And you can divide by, well, multiply by T1 and divide by T2. And so this gives you that Q1 over T1 minus Q2 over T2 is small or equal than 0. Or if you are clever enough and you introduce a convention that the heat entering an engine is always positive, so the Q2 is actually subtracted the heat from the engine. So if I now take, well, I want to change this minus to plus, so I just introduce a different notation. So Q entering engine positive convention. So then I just turn this to sum over Qi over Ti is small or equal than 0. More generally, so I'm just changing that minus to plus by introducing the convenient convention. And then generalizing this relation for 1 and 2, I can put actually many. So I'll have Q1 over T1 and Q2 over T2 if I have many more interesting things. Or, of course, for a closed cycle, or for closed cycle, I have that delta Q over T is more equal than 0. Okay, and so you remember that equality here is if and only if your cycle is reversible. So equality for reversible All right, so this thing is sometimes called Clausius theorem. And basically, it's for many purposes, it's all you need to know about thermodynamics is this theorem here. Okay. So now how does this introduces the entropy is very, very simple. So you know that for reversible, there is an equal sign. Okay. So if there is an equal sign, so the left-hand side is a circular integral. If I go around the circle, I return back to the same position, then I integrate something, I have to get 0. So now, of course, if this is true, that something what I'm integrating here has to be a total differential. That's the only possibility. Okay, so you then define the entropy to be that total differential. So definition you define entropy S. As ds equals to delta q reversible cycle over t. Okay, so if I have reversible cycle, I have equality sign here. Something, if I integrate over the whole cycle, I have to get zero. So this must be a total differential in that case. And so that's my definition of entropy. So s is, again, a function of state. So something that will not depend on the path which you go. So, okay. Yeah, questions? No questions? People still with me? More or less? Yes?
So wait, we have this definition of entropy in terms of the heat for a reversible process. So what if our process is not reversible, and how do we define entropy?
Oh, very good. That's a good question. So I will not answer that question, but I will hint on that. Thanks for that question. So now imagine that, again, I have point A and point B, and I can go with one path, which is reversible, and the other one, which is irreversible. So now the statement is, of course, if this is a function of state, then the entropy here, so I start with some entropy here, I end some this entropy here, and of course, no matter which path I take, the entropy has to be the same. Okay, so then, of course, you define the increase of the entropy through the reversible one, right? So that's the simplest way how we calculate. Yeah. So now, of course, I know that that thing must be true. So an integral over circle, delta q over t is more or equal than 0. So this is true. So if I go, let's say, this way and that way, then the whole thing must be small or equal than 0. That's the Clausius relation. So now this is an integral from A to B of delta q over t. And then I put the other one. So then I'll have an integral from B to A. So this is the irreversible. And then I'll have from B to A reversible. So this is must be equal to A to B delta q reversible over t. So this is just ds. So this is equal to sb minus sa. So you define really the entropy through the reversible part, but you also have this beautiful relation. So you have that for general delta q, this must be true. So if I do the differential version of this, then ds is bigger or equal than delta q over t. Okay. So for general heat, this will be true. If this is a reversible cycle, then it will be exactly equal.
So delta QR also the function of state?
Sorry, delta Q?
Delta QR.
This one? Uh-huh. That's the reversible cycle.
So is it a function of state?
Yes. In that case, well, just a second. So reversible, that doesn't mean that the work isn't done. Second question, is it? Well, obviously, if this guy is a total differential, this guy does not have to be, right? So this is an integration factor for this guy, so that this is a total differential. So no.
So when you say it's a function of state, it means that it's a function of P and V?
So what I mean is that, what I mean is that if you, no matter which way you go, you end up, you know, at the same value of that. So the state the final state is completely, well, it's characterized by the value of S. So if I have some P and V in the final thing, then I'll have S. Okay? But it doesn't matter which way I go there. How do I get there? Whether I compress or expand or whatever. As long as I end up in the same state, then I have the same internal energy and I have the same entropy.
But the state, I mean, what's the definition of state? I mean, is the state just the equation of space? So
it's not the equation of state, but it's related to the quantities that the variables that characterize the gas, for example. Yeah, so it's end up with the same, with this gas, with this pressure and that volume. Okay, so that's my state, final state. No matter how I got there, I'll end up with the same internal energy, and I'll end up with the same entropy.
Okay, the same of the state means the same intensive quantity.
Well, it's not enough to specify intensive quantities. There are some extensive ones as well, but yeah. No, but don't think about it too complicated in complicated ways. So simply, state is something which characterizes my system. Okay, so that completely characterizes the system. So now I have the gas which looks like this. Okay, so now to this gas I assign some entropy and some internal energy, and so a different gas with exactly the same state will have the same internal energy and the same entropy. Okay, we can talk about it. You don't seem convinced.
You're saying that I describe my state with my entropy.
Sorry, you describe?
You're describing my state using the entropy and inertial energy.
No. So you can describe the state in terms of P and V, for example, right? But I'm saying for a given P and V, I also have fixed entropy. So on the other hand, look at the difference. So the P and V are directly observable macroscopic quantities. So that's something I can easily measure. Entropy, I can't measure. Entropy is some auxiliary variable, something which actually is an abstract thing, but which characterizes the state equally as P and V in some sense. Okay. So why you introduce that is because it gives you many, many interesting properties, and it allows you to tell a lot about the system. And you wouldn't be able to do it just with P and V, so you have to introduce this entropy, and then many things in terms of the entropy become simple. But yeah, it's another characterization of the same thing, if you want. Okay, so this is a beautiful relation. So dS is bigger or equal than delta Q over T for any reversible or irreversible. If it's reversible, it's exactly equal. Okay. So now, in particular, this is very interesting for isolated system. For thermally isolated system. Of course, I have delta Q equals to zero. So dS is bigger or equal than zero. Okay, so that's the famous thing, is that the entropy actually increases. Okay, and that has many theological but also other consequences. So maybe just the buzzword to use, this sort of defines the arrow of time. Okay, so many microscopic theories are time reversible. So you can equally go this way or that way or backwards in time. But the system as a total system has to behave such that the entropy actually never decreases. If the entropy never decreases, it tells you which way the system actually has to move. Okay? And so it defines the arrow of time, and there's lots of discussion and interesting subject about this. And so you can sort of think about time evolution in the universe as a consequence that there is somewhere in the universe there is no thermodynamic equilibrium. That's why the entropy is actually increasing, and so that sort of tells you, well, there is something in the past and there's something in the future. Okay, so this is really out of time. That's the only place where actually something becomes not reversible in time, right? So the microscopic laws typically are reversible in time. But it's the thermodynamics which tells you, no, actually it's not. Okay, so this is, so by the way, once you have the entropy, so this is a very interesting topic. I encourage you to read about it, but let me leave it here. So once you have the entropy, of course, you can write the first law as this thing, minus PdV or whatever. Well, this is my delta Q, this is my delta V. So now I just write delta Q as TdS. So, and again, typically this won't be a total differential. This won't be a total differential, but left-hand side is total differential. Similarly, you can write C, which is delta Q over dt as T ds over dt. So T. Okay, so once you have the entropy, this is the formula for the heat. Okay, so now I'm already out of time, but I can still go 5 minutes, I think. So that's about second law. Finally, the third law is a little bit boring, but not really. So it tells you what happens when the thermodynamic temperature goes to zero. And so, okay, that's the meaning of the third law. And in particular, what happens with the entropy as the thermodynamic temperature goes to zero? And the statement is basically the entropy has to be the same for all systems. And you can choose it, at least classically, you can choose it equal to zero. Okay, so the third law. So the entropy of an equilibrium system at t equal to zero, so at absolute zero, is exactly equal zero. Okay, so it determines what the entropy is. So if you are looking at the last relation which I have written, so the heat, specific heat, is equal to T ds over dt. So we can integrate that relation. So we have C over T dt. So C over T dt. So now you integrate that, let's say from zero to some temperature T. So now this is equal to plus an integration constant. Dx. So I integrate that relation to obtain my entropy at a temperature T, which is given by an entropy at zero, which is my integration constant. And then I'm integrating this guy here. Okay. So you see that to specify what the entropy is at any temperature T, I really need to know what the entropy is at temperature equal to zero. And so the third law tells you, well, actually, this does not depend on the system. So this is equal to S zero. So for all systems, this will be this. So X stands for, you know, various other parameters, various other systems. I can have one system, I can have another system. So this X distinguishes these systems. So now I'm saying this is independent of the system, and you can set it equal to zero. So once you do that, you know that the S, the entropy at any temperature, is already completely fixed. So fixes completely S.
Did you say classically we can do that?
Sorry?
Did you say classically?
Well, classically always true.
Classically you mean by
quantum mechanically. Micro. Yeah, whatever. You can have some degeneracies in even at t equal to zero. So then you wouldn't have s equal to zero. Yeah. Okay, so basically if you want, you can think about the third law as something which fixes the entropy completely. You can also show that as a consequence of this, it is impossible to cool the system to t equal to 0 by finite number of steps. Okay, so this is a consequence of the third law as well, and typically that comes from the fact that really, you know, whatever approaches to zero, well, the entropy of this thing actually has to be universal. So typical example of this is if S, so zero is here, if S were not approaching to zero, let's say this is x1x and this is x1, this is x2 process. So then I could go, let's say, going like this. And so after several steps, I could actually end at t equals 0 if the S were not universally 0 at 0. Okay. However, so versus if in one process I have this thing and another process I have that thing, but I end up at the same 0 here, then if you repeat the same steps, actually you go all the way to infinity. Okay, so infinite number of steps is needed to reach zero. Okay, so this is a consequence of this, that you can choose S0 equal to zero for any process. Okay, so final word I want to say, so we talked about here about the internal energy. And so the internal energy typically is given as a function of the entropy and volume, and the differential has this form, TdS minus PdV. So more generally, you can talk about thermodynamic potentials. And so thermodynamic potentials are related to the internal energy through the Legendre transformation. And you can just choose instead of function of entropy, I can choose to a potential which is function of temperature. So you can always exchange between the conjugate quantities. So I can and so what is interesting about thermodynamic potentials is that in thermodynamic equilibrium, these are typically minimized for given external conditions. So if you want to find really what the equilibrium is, you think about, well, I have to, for example, keep the entropy and volume fixed, then I know that dU is equal to zero, so U is minimized. Okay, if I want something else, then it will be a different thermodynamic potential. And all these potentials are connected by this magic square I showed you in the classical mechanics course. Okay, so it's also reviewed in the study text, so you can look at the magic square. So thermodynamic potentials, potentials are given by magic square. But what is really interesting about that is that they are minimized, you know, for given thermodynamic quantities, for given external parameters you held fixed, then the corresponding potential is held fixed. And so the most interesting for statistical physics is the free energy, which is just U minus TS. So you just do the Legendre transformation in T and S quantities. And so you end up is dF equals to minus S dT minus PdV. And so we will see this relation many times in our statistical physics course. And so that's the thermodynamic potential which is typically most useful for statistical physics. Okay, so this is an example of thermodynamic potential, one of them when I do the Legendre transformation in T and S directions. So now in the study text, you have all the other potentials as well, and then you have again explained the magic square. And you will practice this in your tutorial today as well. Thank you so much. Any questions? All right. Well, thanks. See you in the afternoon.